morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's June 23rd. We've got 53 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City. I hope everybody's having a great day. Today we have temperatures climbing into the upper 70s, 79 degrees, with sunny skies, an absolutely gorgeous day. We will see variable winds throughout the day, but they're going to be really calm. So at times we're going to see some southerlies, some northerlies. The northerlies are really interesting because there is this frontal boundary really far away, but still we're just seeing kind of aspects of these microclimates happening right now. Overall, just a great day. Nonetheless, clear skies for tonight, overnight lows at 50, and then tomorrow we hit 80s. But we do have that disturbance that I mentioned yesterday, where it looks like we're going to see a trough that's going to develop. It's super unorganized, so oftentimes we refer to those as Bort lobes. Just they're a little messy in the atmosphere, but they will trigger some dynamic activity. I'm seeing the potential for that late Wednesday, so I wanted to build cloud coverage on Wednesday. You're going to start off sunny and you're going to top out at 84 degrees, but second half of Wednesday you're going to see building clouds, and I do think you'll see some isolated thunderstorms, so a heads up there. But those overnight lows, 58 degrees, makes a lot of sense because we have that warm air in place. We also have those clouds that act like a blanket, keeps everything nice and warm. Now on Thursday, I'm going to start us off with some showers, and I do think those showers will kind of hang tight until midday, and then they'll start to clear. On Friday, I'm going with mostly sunny skies, and we could see some convection, just higher elevation. Looks like we could see some activity there. Apart from that, temperatures are going to be fantastic. Upper 70s, 77 is your expected high. Now, on the weekend, we have highs topping out in the 80s with mostly sunny skies on Saturday, but increasing clouds Saturday into Sunday because it looks like we could see another short wave just dig on in very quickly. I'm not expecting any kind of downpours, but just a chance of an isolated thunderstorm, super important for your Sunday. We're going to top out at 79. Degrees of overnight lows in the low 50s. So also keeping that chance of a shower or thunderstorm Monday. Again, really isolated, but because of the outdoor activity, have to mention that and be kind of really strict about that. And make sure that you just guys stay hydrated and sunscreen, apply it often. And I always tell people sunglasses, super necessary with all that sunshine. Eye health is very, very important.
Okay, thanks, Erica.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Summit County Councilmember Glenn Wright. We'll be talking about the RAP tax authorization that's required every 10 years in order to keep collecting the 0.1% sales tax, which is spent on recreation, arts, and parks projects. Republican candidate for the Utah House of Representatives 54th District, Mike Kohler, telling us a little bit about himself. And Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson and planner Hannah Tyler previewing tomorrow's Planning Commission agenda, including another look at the Park City Mountain Resort-based development and the future of accessory apartments. Stay tuned. And stay tuned. Coming up on This Green Earth, right after the local news hour, two segments on the concepts and examples of environmental racism. First, Dr. Dorsetta Taylor, an environmental sociologist and professor at the University of Michigan, talks about the meaning of environmental racism, its history, and why it's still occurring today. And Juanita Constable, a health policy expert with the Natural Resources Defense Council, talks about a study recently published in the online JAMA Open Network that links premature births and low birth weights among Black women with the chronic exposure to urban air pollution and excessive heat during pregnancy. That coming up on This Green Earth this morning, right after the local news hour. Taking a look at local news now at 8:10, an attorney for the Summit Water Company has filed a motion asking a third district court judge to delay his order calling for a shareholder meeting of the private water firm. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, Judge Richard Mrazek called for the shareholders to meet no later than July 3rd, but the water company is pleading that it needs time to file an appeal. It's the latest development in a nearly two-year-old legal fight between Summit Water and the original founders of the company.
As we've reported, Judge Mrazek's decision in May was good news for the group of litigants that include the estate of the company's founder, the late High Saunders, Trilogy Limited, started by another deceased founder, Lurie Knowles, and now run by a Stewart, and the McMillan Marital Trust. The judge granted their request for a shareholder meeting and also ruled in a preliminary injunction that the founders group cannot be prevented from voting their Class A and Class B shares. But Summit Water's attorney, Robert Mansfield, in his motion filed June 17th, said the company will be irreparably damaged given their 2018 lawsuit, which has alleged wrongful conduct by Saunders, Knowles, and their allies. He alleged that the founders have made it known that at the shareholder meeting, they intend to replace the board of directors, fire the current management and officers, and dismiss Summit Water's lawsuits. Mansfield said that undermines the rights of over 4,000 Class B shareholders. The attorney argued the Saunders Knowles shares, which can be voted at the meeting, could later be determined to be invalid if Summit Water's litigation is allowed to proceed. He alleges that when Saunders controlled the company in the 90s, he issued thousands of shares to himself and the Knowles interests, which were not in line with the company's articles. That allegedly gave them control through, quote, an artificial majority of outstanding shares. The filing by Summit Water says they're only asking for a delay in the shareholders' meeting, which will not diminish the rights held by the founders group. Meanwhile, Saunders and Knowles parties have contended in their own lawsuit, also from 2018, that the company improperly tried to cancel or restrict their water shares. In their favor, Judge Morasic ruled that the founders would be irreparably damaged if they could not vote their shares at a company meeting. He said the company doesn't have the legal justification in its bylaws to drop the Saunders and Trilogy shares. Morasic has said the company could only do that by getting a declaratory judgment, but Water has not pursued that option. A related dispute brought out in another court filing is how many positions board of directors can be voted on. Attorney Mansfield has filed a motion asking Judge Morasic to clarify or reconsider his previous order. The attorney says the Saunders and Knowles group want to vote on 5 out of the 6 board members. But Mansfield argued that at most only board members have had them expire. Jerry Dieringer is serving a term that expires here. And Larry White was appointed 3 years ago as a representative of the Canyons Resort. The motion says his term expired in 2019. Other board members have expiration dates running from 2022 to 2024. Summit Water also proposed an expedited schedule for both sides to submit written arguments. That should be complete by Monday, June 29th. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, funding for the RAP tax, which is for recreation, arts, and parks, is provided by a special sales tax initiative approved originally by the Utah State Legislature. It allowed 0.1% sales tax within a county to be collected and then spent on arts and recreation opportunities. Voter authorization of the tax is required every 10 years under Summit County statute, and that means this year, on the November general election ballots, voters will ask whether they want to continue the fund. That is, if one of those who will decide whether it's put back on the ballot. I have Summit County Councilman Glenn Wright. Good morning to you, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this is really a no-brainer, no? At least put it on the ballot and let people decide whether or not they want to reauthorize it?
I certainly think so. This has been a very positive tax and brings really positive benefits to the county, both in the recreation and the cultural nonprofits in our community. It costs very little to each resident, and a lot of it's paid for by tourists, obviously. And, it has brought enormous benefits to the community over the years, including a significant amount of KPCW's funding.
Well, let's talk about any idea how much the fund has raised since it started back 20 years ago?
I can't tell you how 20 years ago, but last year we raised about $2 million total. And that was, it's been increasing over the years. About 3 or 4 years ago, it was about $1.5 million. Now, with the state of the economy this year, I would expect it to decrease. Projections we have from Jeff Jones are that our sales tax numbers could be down 25% to 30% this year and possibly next year. But it's still a considerable amount of money.
All right. So any idea? I mean, you mentioned there's the difference between what residents might put in and how much of the tourist economy funds it. Any idea what that breakdown is?
Last I heard, it's about 50-50 in a good tourist year. And again, this year I suspect it'll be more heavily weighted towards the towards residents, because I expect tourist volumes are going to be down this year and probably early next year.
All right. So what are we doing with this $2 million every year?
Well, I'm sitting at my computer. Let me call up some of our most recent awards. On the cultural side, we, in this past, just last month, we made awards to Arts Kids, Alfengen Museum, Ballet West, building conservation project in Echo, the Egyptian Theater, Kimball Arts, KPCW, Mountain Town Music, Park Silly, Park City Chamber, Park City Film Institute, the Park City Museum, Park City Singers, Park City Arts Council, Sundance, Swanner, Utah Symphony, Utah Winds, and Utah Humanities. And last year, we gave awards on the recreation side to Mountain Trails, North Summit Recreation, Oakley City Rec, Oakley City RV Campground, Park City Ice Arena, Park City Municipal Corporation for Trails, Park City Municipal Corporation for the Mark, Peoa Recreation, Snyderville Basin Rec, several awards there, South Summit Trails, Summit Community Gardens, Utah Avalanche Center, and the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation. And that totaled about $450,000, roughly. We bond on some of the recreation projects because they have to be generally publicly owned, and they're larger dollar projects. And the last time we bonded on this tax increment was in 2012. So all of those awards were made back in the 2012-2013 timeframe. And I do not have current information on those, but they were fairly significant projects.
So it didn't start this way, but I think it's now a 50-50 split between recreation and culture?
That is correct.
All right. And that was a decision made recently by the county council?
A few years ago, yes. I don't remember exactly what year that was. It may have been before my time on the council, or maybe not.
All right. Are you aware of any other projects that we would bond for?
I'm not aware of any right now. If the tax is again approved by the voters, we'll have applications come in from probably the same types of organizations that I listed off there on the annual projects. We don't bond for the entire volume of the tax on the recreation side. We'll bond for part of it, and then the rest of it are pay-as-you-go projects year by year. If there's a good thing to the economic problems we have right now, bonding rates are really low. So I would suspect we would be able to bond for even more projects next year if this is reauthorized.
Okay. Can you give us what 1% means? I mean, for, you know, every dollar spent, we're paying a penny?
Well, for $100, it's 10 cents.
Okay. Let's talk...
That's a good deal.
Let's talk quickly about what kind of discussion our leaders are having this week about the record number of COVID cases this week.
Yeah, you brought that up. I was hoping we'd get some time to talk about that. You can see statewide the numbers are really exploding. And even in Summit County, they're going up a little bit. We're doing considerably better than the rest of the state right now. But we're just in the process of starting to get our summer tourists. Surge. It'd be interesting to see what the governor's office and the commission that's advising him does this week. They've got some pretty strong recommendations from Dr. Dunn that perhaps the state should move back to orange. Personally, I'm not holding my breath on that. I think the biggest thing that has to be done, I would love to see the governor make a mandatory mask usage policy. And if not, several states have made a local option. I suspect Summit County would jump on that if the governor made that available to us.
You still there?
I'm here. Oh,
okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. So you just sound like you dropped off quickly. So this mandatory mask wear, if somebody's not wearing a mask and it's law, I mean, what are we talking about? Are they just cited like a parking ticket or something?
It could be something like that. We would have to create an ordinance to enforce that. And the reality is, I don't think enforcement is going to be the dominant factor if we have a mandatory face mask policy. I've talked to a number of businesses, and some are using kind of universal mask usage for their employees, and some are not. The ones that are, many of them are asking customers to come in that wear masks, but they can't enforce it. At least if we give them the authority to say, look, you know, the county's making this mandatory. We really need you to wear a mask. It gives them a little better standing with customers coming in. The reality is we don't have the enforcement ability to cite everyone walking down the street who doesn't wear a mask or going into a business. But I think what we would see is if a customer's going to get obnoxious with a business saying, you can't make me do it and I'm coming in, that's the kind of person we could possibly go out and cite and give them some type of enforcement ticket. The level of that enforcement is really something we have to decide yet on the county council level.
All right. So in terms of heading back to Orange, my guess is that that's not what the governor wants to do.
That's so, clearly not what the governor and a lot of the economic interests in the state want to do. It may become inevitable if the numbers don't start slacking off. We're now in a pretty frightening increase rate in the state. Dr. Dunn estimates that if we don't damp things down in 3 weeks, our hospital soon could be overwhelmed. If the governor puts off a decision of that nature too long and the hospital system gets overwhelmed, we could see in Utah the kind of disaster that occurred in New York a month or two ago. I don't think we want to see bodies stored in refrigerated containers and mass graves being dug in our cemeteries.
So if the state doesn't, county feels like it's necessary that we go back to the orange phase. Is that something the county can do unilaterally?
We have to ask for an exemption. So that's a decision we'll have to make when we see what the governor does this week. We don't have a council meeting this week, so it's nothing we can really address this week. So I think we'll be looking very closely at what the governor does this week and make a decision early next week on possibly asking for an exemption if that's necessary. The procedures that the state has laid out for all of the counties and cities in the state is that by end of day Tuesday, you have to have your exemptions into General Burton. He takes those to the governor on Wednesday. Sometime during Wednesday, decision is made, announcements are made on Thursday, and typically exemptions go into effect on Friday each week. So that's kind of the administrative calendar we have to deal with next week.
Okay. Glenn, anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I would really sincerely ask all of our population to wear masks when they're in public, and particularly when you're going inside. That's where the biggest hazard is, if you're inside a building. And have some respect for the people you're dealing with. People in our that are working inside of our retail establishments, they're inside all day. And as the virus builds up in there, they're particularly vulnerable. If a couple of them start getting sick, that certain businesses may need to be shut down. So it's both, have some respect for the workers in our community and wear a mask.
All right, Glenn Wright, City Council Member, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:27. Stay tuned, we'll be checking in with Mike Kohler, one of the two Republicans on the primary ballot for Utah State House District 54. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Utah's June 30th primary election, which has about a week more to run, is being conducted entirely through ballots mailed to citizens, but that has led the ACLU of Utah to object that most Utah counties don't provide prepaid postage for the ballots. That group includes Summit County. On its website, the ACLU says that out of 29 counties in Utah, 18 provide postage. The organization said that voting should be easy and accessible and contended that even the cost of a stamp can be a barrier to voting. As the County Chief Deputy Clerk Kelly Robinson said, that postage is something they just choose not to provide unless they're legally required to at some point. She said the cost is one factor in their decision. However, Robinson said they have provided voters with drop boxes throughout the county. Those are located at the Marsac Building in Park City, the Market at Snow Creek, the Ridge Building, Fresh Market at Pinebrook, and on the east side, the Colville Courthouse, Colville City Hall, and the County Services Building in Camas. Meanwhile, the ACLU has organized a campaign called No Stamp, No Problem, which reminds voters that they can mail unstamped ballots. The Postal Service will deliver them and charge the county for the missing postage. Robinson also told us that the Summit County Clerk's Office has received already about 3,000 mail-in ballots. It's 8:29. Well, it's 8:29. Good morning. There are two Republican candidates for the open seat of Utah State House District 54 on the primary ballot this year, Mike Kohler and Randy Favero. The winner of the June 30th primary goes on to face Democrat Megan Miller in the November general election. On the phone to tell us a little bit more about himself, I have Mike Kohler. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So start by just telling us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what your background is.
Well, I grew up in Midway. Me and my wife have six kids and 21 grandkids at this point. And here on my life, I grew up as a farmer, studied economics, ag economics, and other things in school. Ended up farming here. And the last several years, I've been working with other things. My brother now owns the farm that we were on, but I still live here and been involved in the community for many years. Most of what I've done in the past, as far as family or community involvement, I was a county commissioner and county councilman here for many years. Worked with high school kids, coaching, and other things like that. So I've just been a part of the community for a long time.
Yeah.
When our local representative from here, Mr. Quinn, decided not to run and nobody from Wasatch County was interested, I decided to sign up and give it a shot, and looking forward to being able to serve the area.
So are you part of the Kohler Dairy Farm then?
Yes.
That's
My brother runs it. Like I said, now we ran it together for years, and then his family took over about 9 years ago, and now they run the cheese plant and other things here.
Okay. So did that conservation easement then go through? I know that there was a public hearing on that last night.
Yeah, they're still working on it. I haven't heard what happened last evening about it. I did hear it was coming up, but had other things going on.
Okay, and so you're running for office just because you felt like Wasatch County needed to be represented?
Oh, that's part of it. I mean, I think we have the votes over on this side as representing the county, but or as representing the district. But I've just been involved in politics enough to know that a good representative can make a big difference. The state legislature has a lot of power. They can affect our lives, and you need a good representation, a good representative in there to represent your needs, and I think I have the experience to do.
All right. So other than experience, I mean, what other skills do you have? Do you think that would make you the right candidate for this job?
Well, you look at, as I look at it anyway, many of the main topics that we're dealing with are things that I've been involved with. I've been a business owner, and most of us know and have watched the legislature last couple of sessions grapple with the new taxes, taxing system they were putting together. I think that can have a major effect on not only us personally as homeowners and residents, but certainly the business community. I've been working actually as a lobbyist at the state for almost 16 years, and so I've been watching this process and as representing the clients that I had and have, following along and, you know, representing them. But there are some things that I think need to be taken care of to make this transition to a new system a lot more business-friendly. I've been working with agriculture and water for years. Everybody knows how important water is. And I know water ownership and use top to bottom from the agriculture side to transition into culinary uses. And that, I guess, the rural lifestyle and what water can convert is important to me. Certainly property rights and other things. Anyway, long story, but my experience in the past has, I think, put me in a place and given me experience that will be helpful. I just think it's important, again, that whoever represents us has a lot of experience, understands the area, and also can work with other people. I think I have a strength of being able to bring groups together from either political persuasion and other entities to make the final decision a good one.
Yeah. Maybe talk a little bit about how you think you're different than your primary challenger, Randy Favero.
It's hard to say because I've only met Randy once, actually twice. We were on an interview the other day. A fine man, and I think he'd do a great job as well. In many policy decisions and votes, we may not be that far apart. I guess the thing I do bring is I've lived here. I've been part of the community forever, both in the youth and other groups. I've been here. I haven't been, traveling around. So I think I just bring a little bit more perspective. I've watched the change. Park City is kind of ahead of us when it comes to urbanization and crowds, but certainly Wasatch County's coming on fast. I've just watched all this, and where I've been in local government, making decisions regarding land use and zoning and planning and all that has given me the experience that I think will lend itself to me being a little bit more close to the people here.
All right. You mentioned the state's taxes. Is there something that you'd like to see changed with that? And if so, what?
Well, I think everybody, if they've watched, and I think part of the problem with the process, I know the legislators worked very hard, especially Mr. Quincy was part of it here, to make the process that they were trying to implement clear to the public, but indeed it never was. Most of the discussion, in spite of their efforts, didn't make it to the public, so they didn't know. We do have an imbalance between sales tax and income taxes. We have an income tax that's tied to schools. There's a lot of, shall we say, impediments to the flexibility of the tax system. But certainly the effort, in my opinion, that they took on a couple of years ago to reform it didn't need to happen in such a quick way. I think this is going to have to be worked on over time, explained well to the public, well thought out, and then steps taken over time to implement the changes that are required so that as they're understood, and number two, they're friendly to the business community, that we be able to, through these, even though they are going to be business taxes, they'll end up being such that businesses can thrive with them. It's difficult, in my opinion, to start taxing all services in such a quick manner where we haven't been taxed before without knowing the consequences and possibly creating, and I think that's what they did, is ended up doing. If it would have gone through creating unintended consequences, that would have been penalizing to businesses. So I want to be involved in and possibly, if I can influence, slow it down, make it more deliberate, and do it over several years so that as the emergency, which is coming someday, but it's not here yet, the need to have this change made, it will be in place in a timely manner, but in a more rational way.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, I mean, they were proposing just to kind of like rip the Band-Aid off and be done with it. And so the issue of kind of doing it slowly, like you say, in steps over time, then it's a decision of, well, which one, you know, which business goes first? So that could be more of a challenge, no?
That is a challenge, but it's that's part of the game that the legislature plays every year when they either change taxing or budgeting or whatever. So I think once all of that information is put on the table, there'll be a way to do it and such that the fit. Now, is everybody going to be happy? Probably not. But as it was, most people, I think in most cases, from my point of view, and I was involved in it in most of the hearings, so I knew more than most, but I think it was just a case where many people didn't understand it well enough to know who it would help or hurt or whatever and how it would affect them. And then when they threw the tax back on food, it kind of got a reaction that everybody, in my opinion, stopped really thinking about it and just started opposing it.
Yeah. And then with regard to water, I mean, what are your thoughts there?
It depends on which way you're thinking about it. We obviously have times when we have less water than we need. Certainly conservation is a big deal. But I think the biggest thing is being able to have in place, and the state has dealt with water at least 10 bills deep in the last 10 sessions as they work on both ownership, transition, access to fishing and recreation and stuff like that. So the water community, as they call it, has been involved with the legislature in making adjustments over time already, and some of them are well placed. But certainly in times especially of emergency when water is short, residential needs are what they are, we need to have the right rules in place so that those who own the water, and most of the water still in the state is owned by agriculture, and we say owned, the right to use it because it's owned by the state and by the people, but the right to use it is owned by and used by agriculture. And in some cases, they've had, when we have droughts or shortages or specific needs come up, fair transition rules and ability for that water to go where it needs to go for the highest purpose, but yet compensating those who own it and have the right to it is important to me, and that's part of what I want to be involved in over time. Again, it's not new. This has been going on with the water community and the legislature for years and years, and the transition is going in the right direction.
All right. I also wanted to ask you, as I did Randy, if you should go on to win the primary. I mean, what's your strategy to beat Megan Miller, the Democrat in the race? She only lost the last election against Tim Quinn, I think, less than 200 votes.
Yeah, I think it was very close.
And I think she's now a Wasatch County resident.
You know, I've heard both. I know she was for a while, and then I've heard she'd move back. I have not met Megan. That said, I think the best thing I can do, whether it's Randy or Megan or anyone else, is put my best foot forward, let people know what my experience is, get to meet the people, and I think have the strengths both in the diplomatic side and coalitions together, as well as the knowledge of important issues, both in local government and other things, to be the best candidate. So I'll just continue to do that and work with those who are interested, answer questions, et cetera. So I don't know that I have a grand strategy that makes that much different than just getting out there and talking to the people. Listening to them is important. I mean, I can tell them whatever. But one thing as a county councilman is I found out the best thing is to get out and talk to the people. You may, at some point in time, you have to take your best information and make a decision. But the people need to be consulted, and the more you're available, the better you are. I had my cell phone was in look around the whole time I was in the council. I took calls daily, especially on heavy issues, when people had a question about something coming up, and I'll continue to do the same. I want to be accessible, and that's all I can do is put out what I would do and let them worry about it.
So I've seen lots of your signs around the Park City area. Have you been spending some time in Park City, kind of, you know, knocking on doors?
I haven't done a lot of door knocking. I've visited quite a few people and businesses and other things. In a primary that's with this many people, it's difficult to get as much personal visits as you can, especially for me at this point in time with have a little bit of things going on with my work. But yeah, I've spent some time over there visiting some. Hopefully enough, but you never know. More is better anytime.
Sure. And just another 3 seconds, Sammy, to tell us why Republicans should vote for you in this primary.
As I said before, I think I bring experience, my local government experience, and working with all levels of government, as well as a lobbyist for the last several years has given me experience working with the legislative process. I can hit the ground running and be effective as a legislator right off the bat. Most people that are, not most, but many people that are lobbyists were legislators first, and then they decided to make a little money and do a lobbyist. But I'm going the other way. I'm bringing my lobbyist experience and a knowledge of the way things work down there to and offering it as a legislative person. I love visiting with people. I also think that it's great to have a seat on the inside. lobbying is one thing, being a personal a resident and talking to my legislators one thing, but there's nothing like having a seat on the inside when the actual decisions are made, and that's what I think I can do and represent our people well.
All right, Mike Kohler, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks for the call.
Mike Kohler, again, is one of the two Republican candidates for the open seat of Utah State House District 54. This is the Wasatch County Park City Municipal seat. Again, the winner of the June 30th primary goes on to face Democrat Megan Miller. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:43. It's 8:45. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. 57 degrees now in Old Town Park City. And just blue sky, as far as the eye can see here from the KPCW studios. Looking for sun and a high of 78. Clear skies tonight. We drop down to a low of 52. Sunny tomorrow, 83 is the expected high. Slight chance of an afternoon and evening thunderstorm. Looking for some rain showers perhaps on Thursday morning. Otherwise, partly sunny with a high of 79. And on Friday, looking for mostly sunny skies with a high of 76. KPCW News Time now, 8:45. Good morning. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meets Wednesday at 5:30 via Zoom. You can go to parkcity.org to get instructions about how to participate. On the phone with a preview of the agenda items, I have Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson along with Planner Hannah Tyler. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So up first in work session, Bruce, another look at the Park City Mountain Resort base parking lots. The news is that the planning department and the applicant apparently can't stipulate to the scope of review for this project. And it seems like the Planning Commission thinks that there should be a new master plan because there are so many changes to what was approved back in 1998. I'm thinking the applicant says no. So what do we do?
Well, that's why we're going back to the planning and work session, is to get the Planning Commission a definitive determination on whether this is a new master plan or not. I think there's some complications in the issue with respect to how many obligations Park City Mountain Resort has versus how many obligations the base area developer has. So, you know, while this may be a new master plan, there may be some sort of blended development agreements between the two of them, because transit, for example, kind of exists between both of the agencies. The parking exists between both of the operating entities as well. So I think the Planning Commission is leaning towards a new master plan. I think the scope of that master plan still needs to be considered, and we're going to have that conversation tomorrow night.
All right. And that's what, like you mentioned, is that issue here. So many of the base operations and the mountain upgrade plans remain under the authority of Vail. So should Vail be a co-applicant here?
Not at this point. It depends kind of on what other things the Planning Commission wants to look at and whether they're under the control of Vail Resorts.
A site visit is scheduled for July 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. After touring the new site, do you think you'll be able to then figure out the scope of review?
Well, I think we're going to try and figure out most of it tomorrow night. And then the Planning Commission can give us an idea of what else they want us to look at. Well, the schedule that Planner Ananth has put together is almost 8 months worth of work. So this thing is going to be a little fluid till we come out the other end.
Well, the timeline in the packet shows that this could be approved as soon as the end of October. And after that, the idea would be to begin construction as soon as possible, or do we have to wait for, you know, the snow to melt?
The way the applicant has put together their package, they need to deliver the same amount of parking at the end of a construction season that they started with. So I would expect that they would start in the spring, in order to make sure that they could maintain the parking.
All right. One of the comments that as I was reading through them noted the location of a helipad hasn't been located. Do we have a current helipad there?
There are a couple of designated helipads on the mountain for emergency use. One is down by where the Intermountain Clinic is.
All right. So this isn't for the Uber helicopter?
No. Right now it's for the emergency helicopters.
So yet to be determined whether Uber helicopters would be allowed to land?
Yeah, that's another whole use problem that we would have to work through with the Planning Commission.
And then just kind of going through the staff report and trying to read through the public comments, can't somebody just put them all together instead of like 60 pages of this gobbledygook? I mean, sometimes the comments are repeated three times. It just seems really, I don't know.
Well, you know, the Planning Commission likes to read everybody's comments. Ultimately, we'll end up summarizing the comments in the staff report. But right now, the Planning Commission likes to see each individual comment.
All right. And like I said, I mean, there just doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason because some of them are in there three times, the same comment.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
They've just been filed three different times. Is that what you're telling me?
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right, Hannah, the next work session item is for the accessory dwelling units, or ADU. What are you looking for from the Planning Commission?
So what we're doing is we're having a work session about accessory apartment regulations and, you know, just accessory dwelling units in general. And that's at the request of both Planning Commission and City Council. And so, you know, currently accessory apartments are allowed in all residential zones and most commercial zones. And so what we're going to be talking about is the specific criteria to have an accessory apartment and try to identify if there are any impediments to the development of these types of units. And an example of an impediment might be the parking requirement. So when you have an accessory apartment, you have to park every bedroom. So, and that's in addition to the existing parking that's required for your main house, which is two. So when you maybe make a one-bedroom accessory apartment, you now have to provide one parking space and get that completely on your property. And for some people, that's physically impossible simply because they don't have the room. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is have that discussion with the commission to identify those impediments and determine if it's something that we want to explore amending, because ultimately we see accessory apartments as yet another tool in the toolbox as we look at housing in Park City. And so, you know, that's not to say that accessory apartments will be deed restricted as affordable housing, but we just see them as an important part of our long-term rental pool. And so, you know, with the proliferation of nightly rentals, we've continued to lose these long-term rentals. And so we're just trying to make sure that we aren't impeding the development of these types of units as they contribute to the housing in Park City.
Yeah. So can you explain the difference between an accessory apartment and an accessory dwelling units?
Yes. So an accessory apartment is a defined term in the Land Management Code. And basically, it's when you turn a portion of your existing house into a separate apartment or a portion of your garage, so like a unit on top of the garage. And we don't define accessory dwelling unit. And so what we're asking them to do is just say, do you guys want to expand the definition to allow these accessory apartment type uses in an accessory structure on the back that's not a garage? Because, you know, the requirement to have it either attached to the garage or the house is also yet another impediment. And so if they want to expand them to be just a freestanding structure on the site, we would need to change the definition. And what we would maybe want to do is just change the name so that we can expand that use.
So is that when you have a tiny home if it's not attached?
So, yeah, I mean, that would technically be a tiny home. And so that's part of the discussion. And that was, again, at the request of Planning Commission, was they just wanted us to bring them sort of just an explanation of a tiny home and how that would fit into our code. And the simple answer is it currently doesn't fit into the code because we don't have a definition that would meet it. And so that's part of the discussion is, do you want to expand this to include those new types of units, again, as a yet another tool to have some more long-term rentals and also just, you know, be more of an income for some of our property owners. That's a lot of the reason why people end up adding accessory apartments is either for their family or to have yet another income, help them be able to stay in Park City.
So where are the allowed uses? It sounded like you said that accessory apartment units are allowed in all zones.
They're only not allowed in four, so they're allowed almost everywhere. The reason you don't see as many is, you know, either it's the CCNRs don't allow them, or they can't meet the criteria. And so that's part of the issue is it's a combination of both. So, you know, there's a couple things we could do to change that, but that's part of the discussion is identifying with Planning Commission how they want to address this.
So if CCNRs don't allow them, I mean, can you approve them?
So we don't regulate, the city does not regulate CCNRs. So if someone came into us with an accessory apartment, if it's a conditional use, there would be a noticing requirement. So in theory, those individuals next to them would be getting a notice. But, you know, that's part of the HOAs to be regulating themselves in that instance.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about more parking, about parking. I mean, the city has already reduced parking requirements for some of its affordable units, so it sounds like we've got some precedent for that.
You know, we haven't reduced parking yet for affordable housing, but, you know, that is something we're looking at on a global scale, and we'll be coming to Planning Commission with a discussion on parking in general and if our current parking codes are accurate for, you know, today's time.
Yeah. And you also mentioned nightly rentals. I mean, how do we ensure that these units, if they were to be built, are not then being used for, you know, an Airbnb situation?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways. Is number one, in order to legally do a nightly rental, you do have to get a permit through the city. And so we would be able, the planning department does review those, even though those are technically through the finance department as a business license. The planning department does review those, so we would be able to catch it then. But then the other piece is that right now the regulation has a deed restriction, not only that the unit be owner-occupied, but that nightly rental is not allowed. And so there's a couple ways in that if we, you know, if someone did a nightly rental illegally with no permit, there's an issue with that in that you don't have a business license for that use, but you'd also be in violation of the deed restriction. So we have a couple ways to catch them.
Yeah. And are we talking size limits?
At this point, there is a size restriction on the use, and I think that's going to be something that we could talk through with Planning Commission. I don't know that staff is necessarily in favor of increasing the size simply because, you know, at some point you start to become a duplex dwelling and there's some other use issues. And so we're just trying to make it secondary to the main house and really just be, you know, one or two bedrooms in many instances.
Yeah. Are we talking about any allowances perhaps for some reduced setbacks?
You know, that's going to be part of the discussion with Planning Commission. That's something they could absolutely bring up.
Yeah. And what about the requirements for review? I mean, it's expensive to have floor plans drawn up to even approach the planning department.
Yes, but I also, you know, if you're going to go get a building permit, you need to do a lot of those plans anyways. It's going to make sure that, you know, it's safe and it meets all the building codes. And so that has been a concern that people have brought up, but we have to remind them that they're going to have to do it to get the building permit anyways. And so really they're just doing it a little bit early in the process than they would have otherwise.
All right. And you had mentioned deed restrictions. Would a deed restriction on the accessory apartment unit be required?
Right now, yes. In order to have one, you have to have the deed restriction because it's a notice to the next purchaser of the property that there is an ownership requirement and things like that. And so it's more of a notice to property owners in the future, but it's still on there and it memorializes all of the things that the property owner had agreed to when they were approved for a unit.
Okay, but nothing about it having to be affordable in terms of that?
No, so no. Currently, the requirement is they do not have to be affordable housing. And that's not necessarily something that the city is even pursuing right now because, again, we don't necessarily see this as needing. We need affordable housing, obviously, but we really do need long-term rentals. And so we think that this will hopefully kind of fill that middle gap of people in the middle don't necessarily qualify for affordable housing but still need a place to live.
All right. So any talk, because I've brought this up years ago and it was pretty much just dismissed immediately. But I mean, the city, you know, spends a lot of money on affordable housing. If you're looking, you know, to provide some affordable housing, is there talk about providing some grants to property owners who maybe like you do with the historic district that would give them the capital to build AAAU? I mean, you know, the city certainly could restrict the rent on the unit until the loan plus interest is paid back, no?
I mean, that's definitely something that the city council could consider from a policy perspective. I don't think that that's something that the Planning Commission necessarily would have the authority to be looking at. However, you know, we're going to be going to city council with a discussion on the housing resolution, and I think that that will be a really good time to have a discussion like that on some financing or at least some fiscal strategies to help the community build these if that's the direction we want to go. But I think that will be a discussion we will save for council and obviously invite Planning Commission to the table as we start to have those.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Anything real quick that you wanted to mention, you or Bruce?
No, thank you, Leslie. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, Hannah, Bruce, thanks for your time. KPCW News Time now, 8:59. It's 9 o'clock. Stay tuned. Coming up, we've got NPR News, followed by This Green Earth. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. 56 degrees now in Old Town, looking again for some sunshine. A high today of about 79, winds calm. Overnight low of about 52. Tomorrow, looking for a high of about 83 with a chance of an afternoon and evening thunderstorm, maybe even some rain Thursday morning. This is KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.